Somewhere across the bifrost, way up high.
Welcome back to the latest episode of Across the Bifrost. My name is Sung Soo, and joining me, as always, is the newly married Pat Dunford from Across the Pond. Pat, how you doing? How's married life treating you?
So far, so good, TT. It's been just a few days, but right now we're over the moon.
Awesome. Well, congratulations again, my friend. And today, we're going over the unstoppable box of Kane Marco. But before we dive into that, we have the very popular episode, Sleeve It or Heave It. And Pat, I have a confession to make about Sleeve It or Heave It.
What's that?
Way back when we started this, you said we should keep a list of the cards that we do for Sleeve It or Heave It. And I kind of brushed you off as like, what kind of silly nonsense is this? And now I think I have to go listen to like 20 episodes and write down all the Sleeve It or Heave It cards because I can't remember them anymore.
I think it's great that we ran into this problem where we couldn't remember which ones we'd done. And then I asked in our Discord for our patrons, hey, what Sleeve It or Heave It should we do? And like the first three or four suggestions, I was like, no, we've definitely done all of those already.
Yeah, so mistakes have been made. I apologize to the listeners and to you, Pat. But today we're covering Grievous Wounds, an unaffiliated reactive card. During character's activation, when it targets an enemy with an attack, it may spend a single point of power. Yeah, pretty cool, pretty cheap. If the target character is dealt damage by this attack, the target character cannot have damage removed from it this round. What do we think of Grievous Wounds?
So Grievous Wounds is one of those cards that sees some play as an answer to a problem, right? It's not very good on its own merits, but it's good for stopping healing effects. And the notable healing effects being the restricted cards, Medpack and Patchup, and then Field Dressing, which heals 1 point and removes the dazed condition, plus a few characters, right? The more popular ones are Doctor Strange. The classic Doctor Strange can heal. Hood is new, pretty popular, and is able to heal for three. And there's a few characters that see a bit of play that can heal themselves, like Venom and the Healing Factor characters. So there's quite... Yeah, and Groot is getting a bit of a resurgence and he heals himself very well. So there's quite a lot of targets for this effect, and that's why you take the card, right? To stop down these healers.
Yeah, so things I like about the card, it only costs one power. Things I don't love about the card, it is tied to a singular attack, right? So it's similar to, I think it's a trip up, right? Where you have to be able to get damage through with this attack. And honestly, reminds me a lot of the Thor stagger on his for Asgard, right? Where if that attack doesn't pay out, you're not feeling great about stuff.
Oh, yeah, you feel real bad. And it's very rare for a tactics card to have that kind of stipulation on it. And it just feels awful when it fails, right? And you just flush your card down the drain.
Yeah, so I remember when it came out, I was pretty excited about it. But I think at that time, it was a slightly different meta, right? We were seeing a lot more like, oh, you've got MODOK coming back with the Field Dressing. Mm-hmm. I think I was a lot more concerned with negating the Resurrection card or the Healing card than I am now. I honestly, now whenever I look at the thing, I kind of just heave it, to be honest. Have you found a better use for it?
I do think it has its uses, obviously. All the stuff I just mentioned is valid. I think the problem is, like you said, the risk that it just doesn't work, combined with the fact that it can be stopped by so many defensive effects like bodyguards and similar tactics cards. Sacrifice and Heroes for Hire are all over the place right now. Mm. And both of those cards, like bodyguards, stop the effect. You have to play Grievous Wounds first, you target the character you want to cut off healing, and then they Heroes for Hire, and your plan is foiled. So the fact that it's stopped by so much stuff, and even if it works, you might just get bad dice, has really turned me off the card. And I just feel like healing is not so common that I need a card to counter it.
Yeah, that's fair. It's interesting, right? When the BNR list first came around, right, it was super common just to see a double healing card out of that, right? Or maybe you see Brace in a healing card. Now, obviously, it's kind of evolved past that. And, you know, towards the end of the eight, I was seeing a lot of times where you weren't even seeing a double BNR card. So the meta's definitely evolved around it. And I think Grievous Wounds just hasn't kept up. Like you said, pointing out the timing quirks of it, I think is super important. Because like you said, you do have to announce this on attack before you get to know what's happening behind the scenes. So I think I'm comfortable heaving Grievous Wounds. Unless you are, like you said, some very specialized situations, right?
Yeah, and it has to be super specific, because bear in mind, you're playing this card to stop them healing. But, like, playing Grievous Wounds doesn't take their med pack out of their tactics cards and tear it up. It just stops them using that med pack on that specific character on that specific turn. So your counter card costs you a whole card to play, but often doesn't counter that much, right? It maybe just delays the inevitable healing or forces it onto a different target. So yeah, I'm also heaving Grievous Wounds. I think it's a very overrated counter pick.
Yeah, and I think the other thing we both kind of talked about is obviously it's really dependent on do you have a character that can consistently get a point of damage through, right? Which is the other obviously huge aspect of the card. So Sleeving Grievous Wounds, I'm remembering this one. We're writing down in the spreadsheet. We are 1-for-20 on our Sleeve It or Heave It so far for recording purposes. But on to the meat and the potatoes, a character that we opined about way back the first time you were on the show, Pat, before you were a regular contributor, the Juggernaut. What do we think of the Juggernaut?
Oh, well, I am a fan of the Juggernaut. What a cool character. I think this might be my favorite character to date that Atomic Mass have released. He's just, the design for this guy is so incredibly cool, and he's so unique, right? He really lives up to his depiction in the comics, and he plays unlike anything else on the table.
Yeah, very, very flavorful, and I have, I think I talked about it last episode, I've greatly enjoyed my games whenever I've gotten them on the table. So Juggernaut, Kane Marco, is a 5-threat character, which puts him into some rarefied air. He has 8 stamina on his healthy side. He's a short mover. Well, it's okay. He's size 4. He's a little thick. And he has 4-3-5-4 defense. On his injured side, his defenses change a little bit. It just goes to 4-3-2. We'll get into that in a bit. He's a 5-dice strike with a wild push on it. Power equal to damage dealt. And then he has a 4-dice spender, range 2, 7-dice. I'm the Juggernaut with a wild trigger for rush. After this attack is resolved, if it is during this character's activation, this character may immediately use Nothing Stops the Juggernaut superpower without paying its power cost. So I guess we might as well roll the powers. Pat, what does Nothing Stop the Juggernaut do?
This is the big one, right? This is the most defining feature of the Juggernaut. It's a 3-cost active power. And when you use it, Juggernaut is pushed short. And he does not stop his movement if he contacts terrain that's size 3 or less. Instead, that terrain is destroyed. And when he contacts a character, that character suffers 1 damage. On top of that, he can also use this ability to remove stagger. So if you have 3 power at the start of your activation before you use either action, you could use Nothing Stops the Juggernaut, remove the stagger, so you don't have to forfeit one of your actions.
Yeah, so pretty huge superpower, right? For that activation movement, non-activation movement, right?
Yeah, he can go a long way because he's on the largest base. On top of that, his other superpowers are very good. He's got Nice Punch, which is a 1-cost reactive power that lets him reduce damage by 1, similar to characters like Kingpin or Crossbones. He's got Helmet, which means that he can't be pushed or advanced by enemy mystic attacks or by superpowers like web lines from spider people. And he's got another signature effect, Unstoppable Momentum, which is after he takes a move action during his activation, he gains 2 power, and the next attack that he makes in the activation adds 3 attack dice to the roll. He can only benefit from that once per turn, but it makes his move action into like an incredible powerhouse. He's also immune to stun. And then on his injured side, a couple of things change. I love the idea that his helmet gets ripped off. So like you said, TT, his mystic defense goes down to 2 and he loses the helmet ability. So he can then be moved by mystic attacks and by superpowers. But he makes up for it by gaining Avatar of Cytorak, which is a 3-cost size 3 throw, which throws medium and can throw characters or terrain.
So can you stop the Juggernaut, Pat?
It's difficult, right? This guy is one of the toughest characters for his threat value in the game, especially his healthy side. 4-3-5 defensive array with damage reduction and 8 stamina. That's a lot of meat to chew through.
It is, and he's able to turn around any power you do give to him into pretty impactful abilities and attacks on the flip side. It's also worth noting, like you said, Pat, he is on the largest base out there, so that short move does actually move him a fair bit of distance. So he is able to get around, especially when you factor in the Nothing Stops the Juggernaut. Kind of once he gets that power going to enable him to Nothing Stops the Juggernaut double attack each turn or just rely on unstoppable movement, he's a very fun piece to play. I mean, he's a nice self-contained engine, I feel. He doesn't need a lot of things to go his way to really impact the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, he just, his default turn, right, under his own steam is really strong. His turn one of just advance, get the power you need to then use Nothing Stops the Juggernaut. Use Nothing Stops the Juggernaut. You're now in the center of the table. You've impacted somebody for one damage and you can throw an 8-dice strike their way, generate more power for the next turn, maybe even use Nothing Stops the Juggernaut a second time. It's really, really strong. And it's worth noting that Nothing Stops the Juggernaut doesn't have a once per turn clause on it. So in the ideal circumstance, Juggernaut is in fact the fastest character at MCP. He could go all the way across the table and back again if he can get the power.
Yeah, the only caveat for Nothing Stops the Juggernaut is he can only damage an enemy character once per round, right? Or once per turn?
Yeah, so I guess to answer your question, what can stop the Juggernaut? It is enemy characters, right? He hits them and then he's like, thunk, and that's it. Even Bob can stop him in his tracks.
Yeah, until he punches him a lot.
Yeah. So I think Juggernaut plays really interesting on the table because he's fast, even in turn one. He's incredibly tough and his damage is respectable, right? I think if there's one thing I was going to criticize, it would be the fact that because his play pattern is usually move, then use Nothing Stops, then strike, he's putting a lot of his turn equity into the output of that strike. And a single strike, it's 8 dice, that's great, but it's not necessarily going to hit the target you want. It's not necessarily going to one-shot people.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. I mean, as far as you have a good amount of control over who you're attacking, like you said, Pat, right? You've got 2 short movements plus this giant base to get to the range 2 that you want, but it is a range 2 attack, and he doesn't have any innate rerolls or anything like that, right? So it's a singular 8-dice attack. We say that like it's nothing. It's a very good, respectable attack.
Yeah.
But when you think about the output of a 5-threat character, does that kind of stack up with everyone else? I think it puts your opponent in an interesting situation, though, right? Because if you do enable the Juggernaut to end up double attacking, then he starts getting a lot stronger. And then obviously I'm the Juggernaut is a great spender. If you're able to combine that with unstoppable momentum, then we're talking about a 10-dice attack, right?
Yes. And all of that is really powerful. I think one thing that's worth mentioning to help quantify Juggernaut's damage output is comparing his 8-dice strike to 2 5-dice strikes. So if you're in a situation where you're next to the target you want to attack, what does more damage, right? Is it better for me to advance even just on the spot and hit once for 8 dice or to hit twice with 5 dice? And actually, mathematically, it's pretty close. It's almost identical if the target has 3 defense dice, slightly in favor of the 8, I think. And then as soon as their defenses get better than that, then the 8 really starts to look better. Bearing in mind, if all you want to do is push them, 2 5-dice is going to get more chance of rolling a wild for the push than 1 8-dice. So basically, against the average target, it's a wash. You can move and hit them once, or you can hit them twice. It works out about the same. You're a little bit more likely to push them if you do 2 5-dice. And if their defenses are better, then the 8-dice strike is going to be better than you, better for you. But the point really is 2 5-dice strikes, that's lousy output for a 5-threat character. Right. So the fact that we're comparing his 8 dice to those 2 5-dice shows it seems impressive, but actually it's not that impressive when it's only a single attack action. And for his threat value, Juggernaut's damage is quite low.
Yeah, I mean, that was the big knock on Cable when he first came out, right? It's a 5-threat character that just puts out some range 5 attacks. Now, Cable is always, I will say this, Cable's almost always able to attack the character he wants to attack between body slide and it just being a range 5, right? As opposed to Juggernaut, like I said. The double moves a lot of movement, like we said, but there is definitely some limitations there. And then placing his base can get a little finicky unless you just start blowing up every piece of terrain, which is something he certainly could do. So he definitely has an interesting play style there for his offensive output. I don't think the Juggernaut is an elite damage dealer, especially when we compare him to some of the other fives. I do think he's up there as far as durability with other characters. And one of the things I want to talk about is the nice punch superpower. We've talked about that before. It's existed on other characters. And I think there's actually a lot of depth into when do you want to use power to reduce incoming damage. What do you think about that, Pat?
For sure, there really is, because, of course, taking damage gives you power. And Juggernaut could use his power pretty effectively, turn it into more moves and damage by ping-ponging himself around. These effects that we've seen, like you said before, in other names, have this weird kind of double cost to them. Because normally, if I take one damage, I get one power. Great. If I pay a power to not take that damage, I'm also not getting the power that I would have got. So option one, take a damage, gain a power. Option two, spend a power for no effect. And the difference is like a two-power differential, right?
Yeah, we've seen this come up on Kingpin a lot, where Kingpin has a lot of things he wants to spend his power on. The interesting thing I've found the more I've played Juggernaut is if you're willing to just rely on that five-dice strike, Juggernaut is very self-contained, right? He generates one power, like you said. He uses Unstoppable Momentum to get him the two additional power to trigger Nothing Stops the Juggernaut. So you don't need additional power if you're happy living in that sphere, right? Where all I'm going to do every round is just make strikes.
Yes. And because his strikes are fine, he will get enough power to use Nice Punch pretty frequently, I think. And it's one of those effects where when you're on full stamina, you don't necessarily feel the need to use Nice Punch, right? You've got stamina to burn. And bear in mind, stamina isn't doing anything for you, right? Your character is just as effective at having taken four damage as having taken none. So you just shouldn't necessarily feel obliged to use the superpower every single time on such a tough character. But certainly, as he takes damage, it becomes more valuable to reduce the damage he's taking, and you will have more power to spend to do it. So it's something that I think you should think about every time, but don't automatically assume that it's worth giving up all the power to save the damage.
Yeah, and he does have some great ways to spend power via his tactics cards, which we'll get to in just a few minutes here. And the other thing with any character in the MCP is, right, you do have to look at how much damage you expect to take over the course of the round.
Yeah.
And obviously just make some intelligent decisions there, right? So is there anything else about Kane Marco that we want to cover on his healthy side? Do we want to spend a little bit of time talking about his throw? It's a good throw.
Yeah, I think the throw is good. But honestly, the throw is... it's something we've seen so many times. We know it's good. It's a really good throw. Fantastic. But because it's on his injured side, and because it's quite normal, I don't know there's much to say about it other than you'll be happy to have it when you are flipped. Like, it's a nice consolation prize for losing the helmet. The helmet is the thing that I want to talk about, though, because it's more unique. There aren't that many characters that can avoid the control effects that his can, right? And the list of effects that helmet stops is pretty long.
Yeah, we just talked about PSD one or two episodes ago. Sorry about that. And obviously some of that effect is just negating the movement effect of it. And like we said, that's huge, right? We've talked about the plague that Enchantress was for a long time, or MODOK just bowing tons of people out of the way. I do love the idea that Juggernaut's a character that you can pretty reliably expect to end up activating wherever you end his activation previously, right? He's size 4. So he's naturally resilient to a lot of pushes and throws, especially after the recent card updates. And then we combine that with Helmet, then he doesn't move unless you want him to.
Yeah, the number of characters that could move Juggernaut with superpowers is very small, right? There are not many characters with size 4 plus throws and pushes, and nothing else really works. And those characters that have size 4 plus throws and pushes are themselves expensive, powerful characters. So Juggernaut is going to be pretty immovable, especially against cheap characters, right? Against like swarm teams. And that's probably one of the places that he would shine, against multiple enemies who are doing lots of low value attacks, where a Nice Punch can perhaps get more mileage. And with no way to stop Juggernaut from focusing on the victory points you need to win.
Yeah, he's it is interesting, right? And because I've played him a good amount, and I don't have a definitive answer there. I found one of the issues, if I play into a wide Guardians or a wide Sam team, you just don't get a ton of damage out of Juggernaut, right? So
yes.
it's a bit of a double-edged sword there. Like, are they hurting the Juggernaut? Not really, not super effectively. But how much are you really doing? I'm maybe dazing a character if I roll really well on that 8-die strike. Mm-hmm. But more realistically, I'm hurting a 3-threat character, and next round I'm finishing that character off, right? And it's you do have to kind of pick and choose where he ends up going, right?
So I think that's right. I think the way to play the Juggernaut effectively, in my experience so far, is he needs to be focused very much on the extracts and secures, and he's phenomenal at both, right? Because he's incredibly fast and incredibly tough, which makes him superb at holding extracts, and he's incredibly tough and really hard to move, which makes him superb at holding secures, right? And it depends on the crisis. But for example, I recently played against Juggernaut in a one-day tournament event with my Guardians of the Galaxy team with Ghost Rider that we spoke about in episode 109, right? And we were playing Skrulls, and Juggernaut got the Skrull and then just, ping-ponged himself to the corner of the table. And my Guardians were like, well, the way that we get Skrulls off people is we shoot them dead. But Juggernaut is moving so fast that we just chase him and we don't have any actions left to attack him. And then he goes away again. You know, he'll walk up, punch Star-Lord, get the power he needs to fly away. And what can we do? So he was a very frustrating experience for my shooting team in that situation. And I think that's where he shines, is on those priority extracts where he can hold them and take them away. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there, right? You want to make your opponent have to attack him. You want to make it so he has to, he can't be ignored, right? Because as crazy as it sounds, realistically, you can ignore 1 point of utter damage and an 8-die strike every round from a 5-threat character. Mm-hmm. I don't mind throwing a 2 and a 3 to kind of body block that, to just kind of take up space and to be annoying in that way. So you do have to get things on him. I think a single high-value one like Skrulls is phenomenal for him. Mm-hmm. Senators has the downfall of the defensive dice, which, you know, kind of a little bit counteractive, but I mean, he's still 3 dice with the damage reduction. You're not going to really complain about that. If you can get multiple hammers on the guy, obviously that's kind of a stacking effect where you end up with stuff. But yeah, I definitely think you need to put him in places where he forces your opponent to go in. I think Gamma is an interesting one as well, right? He really can bully the middle Gamma point and then threaten your opponent's Gamma. He doesn't have any innate way to move them off of that outside of just punching them in the face till they go away. But again, putting him in those situations where he has to be focused, I think is key. And like you said, Pat, identifying that he is a scenario piece is important if you want to actually get good production out of Juggernaut.
Yeah, I think so. He's certainly a scenario piece. And I think he's been pretty impressive for me in a couple of teams. I've liked him a lot in Brotherhood. I like that he's incredibly mobile, really good at generating the power for Asteroid M. So it makes him or somebody else like Magneto even more mobile. And I'm so happy seeing him with Brotherhood on something like Skrulls. I think Brotherhood probably want to be taking Skrulls alien ship and maybe Senators if they've got Juggernaut and playing that game plan every time they get extracts. I think it works really well. But I've also been very curious to see him being explored with Wakandan Herb. Have you heard about this one, TT?
I've played it myself a few times. I'm curious what you think about it.
Yeah, so the idea here is that because Juggernaut is so hard to move and so fast, you send him up to get Wakandan Herb and then slowly but surely make your way to score your own Herb. And it's actually very, very difficult for people to stop you scoring your Herb because, like we discussed, most ways of moving him just don't work. And he's tough enough and fast enough that under his own momentum, he scores the Herb pretty quickly and pretty reliably. Now, of course, you can make your life easier, right? You can get him extra power so that he can double move, pick up the Herb, and use nothing stops on turn one with the leadership. You can, or with Advanced R&D. You could use tactics cards like Tactical Analysis. You could use models like Lockjaw. And if you can put together a plan where Juggernaut has scored the Herb on turn one, but even without that plan, like, some teams just can't stop Juggernaut from just walking up, getting the Herb, and walking to the point.
Yeah, I guess my game plans with him I haven't gone for a first turn score. I've gotten second with him pretty consistently, just with like a little bit of shenanigans. I guess you do a first?
You can I'd have to measure do it first. It just depends yeah, how just many, like how much are you sacrificing for your yeah.
exactly like how much are we throwing at this Rube Goldberg machine? I like him there, Mystic. What kind of herbs are weird? We've talked about it. It's a weird crisis. But I do like the Juggernaut, and I have really enjoyed him in Brotherhood. I like that he. I guess normal play for me in Brotherhood is Magneto goes to one side. I heavily overload that side. I have a weak force on the opposing side, right? Magneto wins a side, then he asteroid MC the other side, and I eventually clean that one up, and then I catch back up on scenario, you know, in rounds three or four. And if you are willing to seek the Juggernaut on the alone or isolated side, it can just end up being a huge pain for your opponent, right? He's hard enough to ignore. He's not going anywhere. And if we are playing one of the high-value things, like you said, getting that high-value extract onto him is big. And, yeah, I really enjoy the play patterns. Is it expensive? Yes, but I think it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think he's really cool. So, for me, Juggernaut gets a massive thumbs up. He's unique. He's powerful. I think he'll see a lot of play in all kinds of affiliations. Brotherhoods, for sure, right, where we know he's affiliated. But outside of that, because no one else does anything like him, right, if you want a big, fast, tough character to be very, very strong at scenario play, he's the man to look at, and he could go in any team for that purpose.
Yeah, he's pretty mean in Criminal Syndicate. So I think we're both pretty high on Juggernaut. We've talked a bit about him for a while. Let's go ahead and jump to his tactics cards. The first one he has is Making a Ruckus, right? The unaffiliated reactive card. When another allied character within range 3 of an allied Juggernaut is targeted by an attack, that allied Juggernaut may spend 3 power to play this card. After the attack is resolved, Juggernaut may advance short towards the attacking character and make a strike targeting it. What do we think of Making a Ruckus?
So I think it's worth pointing out, because I see this pop up occasionally on the Discord rules questions. Making a Ruckus is a advance followed by an attack, but unfortunately, Juggernaut's Unstoppable Momentum only works during his activation. And it's going to be very unlikely that this gets played in his activation. So you do not get the bonus power of bonus dice when you use this card, right? You're just doing a short move. And then you're doing a 5-dice strike with a wild push. That's okay. I mean, it's a tactics card that gives you 2 actions, right? And we've said before that we like cards that give you actions. But you're paying 3 power for a move on a character that already can pay 3 power for a move. So all you're really getting out of this card is a 5-dice strike. And I mean, that's all right. But is it worth the tactics card slot, TT?
I don't know. I've enjoyed Making a Ruckus. I have pulled out the illustrious Face Me to Making a Ruckus, so I do get Unstoppable Momentum. If you just want to dump 6 points of power into it, you can definitely do that. I've been taking it in my Juggernaut rosters mainly because I've been testing things and playing Juggernaut. It's his card that has felt the worst to me as we go through, but it is still a powerful card. I do think it's funny. He is mobile enough that I think we're both like, man, it's just more movement. But I think it's crazy that he's mobile enough that we're willing to say that, right? I think you give this card to a bunch of other characters, right? And we're like, oh, this card is incredible. But just because the Juggernaut is so inherently bouncy, we're both just like, it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, basically, it's a move action followed by an attack action. This is a character that makes infinite move actions and whose attack action isn't very strong. So it's not a very good fit for him, you know? If this was on Angela, right, we'd be like, oh my gosh, this card is incredible.
I mean, right? If it was so on it's Venom, very much right? Depends.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's basically about as good on Venom as it is on Juggernaut, except Venom's a cheaper threat. But it would probably be better on Venom, you're right.
I mean, yeah, Venom just struggles from the movement so much. But, I mean, it's hard for Venom to get the 3 points of power. Yeah, anyway.
Anyway, it's not on Venom. Don't worry. If it was on Hulk, we'd be like, sign me up, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd like it on Hulk. Black Dwarf. Black Dwarf needs his card. But
yeah, Black Dwarf could use it. Like, the effect is good. It's just a little bit redundant on Juggernaut because he's already as fast as you want when you have power. So having a Texas card to do that is like...
Yeah, and like we said, it is just a 5-dice attack. We talked about the Rube Goldberg machine to get it to an 8-dice attack. It's not going to happen often. So really, is it worth it to you? I think it's still worth taking in my 10. There are definitely times when I've appreciated the other movement, right? It's one of the ways that I was able to score an herb pretty early, is getting this kind of another movement out of Juggernaut. So I like the card. I don't love it, is what I'll say. I think it's a fine midline card that benefits from us having 10 tactics slots.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the reasons why this card is not super appealing is that Juggernaut's other card is really, really cool. So this card is Do You Know Who I Am? And it's an unaffiliated active card. Once again, Juggernaut can spend 3 power to play it, and you choose an interactive terrain feature or an enemy character of size 4 or less within 2 of Juggernaut, and you throw it long. The only long-range throw in the game.
That's not true.
What else throws long?
MODOK?
Okay, okay. Terrain throws. This is the only long-range character throw. The only way to displace a character that far so easily.
I mean, this card's incredible, is what I'll say. Who doesn't love this? Just chucking a piece of terrain, as MODOK and I think Ebony Maw and a few other characters have told us, is long, it can be devastating. But just throwing a character that far is huge. Yes. It's really incredible. It's a really, really strong card. I take it and use it every time. 3 power seems like a lot. The Juggernaut generates a lot of power. It's not that big of an issue. You end up just taking like the move action, and then maybe you don't want a nothing stops the Juggernaut, so you throw something. It's just, it's really nasty. And it really increases his damage output. We said before, right? He's relying on an 8 dice strike in order to deal damage a lot of the times. So just getting a guaranteed throw out of there is huge.
Yeah, completely agree. This card synergizes with Juggernaut so much better than the previous because of how he works and what he wants to do. Like you said, TT, the fact you can guarantee to generate the power for this, but even without rolling dice, is fantastic during his activation. And the fact that it gives him an activation where he can start to reliably expect to daze or KO his target. Because once per game, it can be slam into you for damage, hit you for an 8 dice strike, and also throw a size 4 of terrain at you. Right? That's just so much better, and it just gives him something that he otherwise doesn't have access to, at least on his healthy side.
If we're playing that scenario game, right, it's like Juggernaut activates, he takes a move, stays within range 2 of you, throws you away long, right, and then he takes 2 other moves to get away from you, right? You end up being... I don't have the math in my head.
A long way. Is that really long? I think that's the answer.
I think it's 18 inches. But yeah, anyway, it's a really far distance. but you end up away from him. Yeah. And it's just an incredibly powerful tool that, like I said, you can use a bunch of versatile ways. So it's interesting that we are both so excited about what's normally a superpower. But if this was a superpower, it would be an insanely powerful one, right? Like I said, the size 4 throw is rarefied air, and I'm happy to spend that on a tactics card.
Yeah, there's one more very important piece of this card that we haven't mentioned yet, which is the fact it doesn't require you to throw during Juggernaut's activation.
Great point.
Which is also really powerful, right? Because we talked about how Juggernaut wants to be standing on objectives, wants to be holding secures. This is a way to keep Juggernaut safe or to keep Juggernaut relevant for scoring even after he's done his thing, right? If Juggernaut is standing on the back enemy gamma, like we talked about, right? Causing problems for your opponents. If their plan is just to go and contest with one of their own characters after the fact, well, in your next activation, even if Juggernaut's already got his tick, you can still play this card, you can throw them away, right? And you can make it very hard for people to go toe-to-toe with Juggernaut, contest points. And it's another way of adding damage outside of activation, right? Juggernaut can throw that terrain long from quite a far distance away from him to help one of your other characters who just needs to push a bit of extra damage through.
Yeah, so I think we both agree. Do You Know Who I Am? It's just a phenomenal card.
Yeah, love it. Happy to play it every time I put Juggernaut on the table. And if Juggernaut's in my roster and I intend to play him a good amount, it would make my 10, for sure.
I end up in a bit of like analysis paralysis of like, is this the right time to use it? But that's a good problem to have just because it's such an impactful card.
I mean, that's how you know a card is great, right? When you're like, oh, there's too many times I really want to use it.
Yeah, great point. As opposed to, oh, the one time a game I might be able to use this card, and then you slam down the other card. So it's been a phenomenal card. So the last card in this box is an interesting one. I really like it. I'm really curious to see what you end up thinking about this, Pat. It's Versatile Strategy. It's an unaffiliated active card. An allied character with an active leadership ability may play this card. You may choose a non-active leadership ability on an allied character in your squad that corresponds to your squad affiliation. There's a whole bunch of words on here. Basically, you can change your leadership. What do we think about that?
So it's very interesting, right? Once again, I want to cover a quick rules question that I've had come up many times. If you see how this is worded, you have to change leadership within the affiliation. You cannot, for example, have an Avengers team that includes Black Panther and then change from your Avengers leadership to your Black Panther King of Wakanda, Wakanda leadership. That's not allowed, right? You could change from Steve to Sam in Avengers. You could change from Mystique to Magneto in Brotherhood. But it has to be within the affiliation. And that means, I think, right now there's five, I think, affiliations with multiple leaders. There's three Avengers with the two Captain Americas and Hulkbuster. They've got three leaders. We got Brotherhood that I just mentioned. We've got X-Men with Cyclops and Storm. We've got Web Warriors with Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man. And we've Cabal. Got Cabal with Sin and Red Skull.
Mm-hmm.
So five affiliations and 11 leaders between those five to choose from. So right now, they're the only ones that can use that. Obviously, more leaders will come out over time, right? And this card will get better as a result. But with what we have right now, TT, who do you like for versatile leadership?
I mean, the obvious one is Avengers. You can take both caps and they can end up being complementary of each other. And being able to switch from Steve to Sam or from Sam to Steve can be incredibly powerful depending on what your opening plan is, right? Being able to start the game in Steve, get some cheap opening powers. When you start taking damage, you see a daze coming and you end up wanting to switch over to Sam. You're a little more power flushed in the early mid game to the mid game. Then we switch over to Sam. I think that's huge. I think the biggest, most obvious one, especially with the popularity of Avengers right now, has to be Avengers, right, Pat?
Yeah, I do think that one's really good. And I agree that you're almost always going to do it in the way you said, right? Start with Steve, where his power discount is better in the earlier turns of the game, and move to Sam as your team starts taking damage, or probably around turn three. That seems great. I think there's one small problem with it, which is just that Steve's leadership tends to be one that you pick characters specifically for, right? It tends to be you're taking characters, at least that plan to use superpowers during their activations, but ideally also have reactive powers. And those characters aren't necessarily the same characters that you want to be taking with Sam Wilson, right? We talked about this in the past in our Avengers episodes, right? So but characters like War Machine and Iron Fist are incredible under Sam Wilson and get no benefit from Steve. So you still have a little bit of that problem of team building where you're like, well, Sam is great under Steve, but is that once I've made my whole team of characters that are good under Steve, how much mileage do I actually get from changing leadership? Because Steve's leadership is incredible and all my characters synergize with it. Do I actually want to change to Sam's halfway through the game?
Yeah, and I think sometimes the answer will be yes and sometimes the answer will be no. And I think that's a great thing to point out with this card. Just because you take it doesn't mean you have to switch, like you said, heading into round three. But I do like the versatility, the ability to switch out. Maybe Sam gets in early, or excuse me, maybe Steve catches in early days. There's a dice spike or something like that. You're afraid you might lose your leadership, so you swap over kind of evasively like that. Well, like I said, the Avengers roster is so wide, Pat. While I do agree that you'll never have, quote unquote, the optimal Sam roster down there, there's plenty of characters that make really good use of both leaderships, right? We've opined about Vision multiple times, right? A character that loves the free move, the power, and the heal that comes off of Sam, and then loves the reduction, either for his defensive abilities or his throw coming with Steve, right? And there's a bunch of different characters that fall into that mold. So I really like it with Avengers. I get what you're saying there. It's not an auto-include. You certainly don't have to your point, but I've enjoyed the flexibility there a lot. I think the other one is fairly intuitive too, but before we jump there, is there anything else we want to talk about for Avengers with this?
No, but I'd want to emphasize a point you made, which I think is really good and applies to any team that can take this card, which is the idea of taking it as an insurance policy if your leader is going to be a high priority target for your opponent, right? It's nice that if your leader runs into trouble, they get an early daze. You can use this card to keep a leadership going longer, even if it's not your preference.
Yeah, absolutely. The other one that I think is pretty obvious is Web Warriors. I think the decision between Amazing Spider-Man and Miles is actually a pretty big one, depending on the crisis and how you kind of want to play the match. But I can see myself switching between the two. I could definitely see it happen, right? Where I'm going to, again, this is me. I think I'm going to open with Friendly Neighborhood Spider Team, and I'm going to switch over to Miles when I'm able to get the points where I feel up and feel a little more defensive. Do you see it the other way around, Pat?
Interesting. Yeah, I think I really like it with Web Warriors because both the characters are good, both the characters are happy to play together, and both the leaderships are good but different, which is kind of what you want, right? Similar to Avengers. But I kind of see it like Amazing Spider-Man's leadership is better later in the game because it requires you to be close to the enemy, like within range two, and it requires you to have excess power. Neither of which is true on round one and is rarely true on round two with spiders. So fair. I see the earliest that you really get a lot of use out of it is round three onwards. You get a bit on round two. And so for that reason, I think it's going to be a bit weird. If that leadership is such a slow burn, it's probably not going to be the case that I then want to switch very, very late, like round five or six to Miles. So I think I would probably try, at least my initial impression, I haven't actually tried this with webs, right? But I would probably start with Miles and move to Amazing. But I could be wrong. You might have it the right way around.
I mean, my logic for it has come down to as simple as this. A lot of times when I'm playing Web Warriors, the game comes down to, can I keep the things I've stolen alive, right? Can I keep my characters alive that have stolen the extracts? So in those situations towards the end game, I want Miles' leadership. I definitely agree with you that you're not using Friendly Neighborhood Spider Team on round one. But hopefully you get at least one trigger off it around two, and then round three, it really starts to come into its own. And then round four, five, or six, if I'm like running for my life from something, then I'm happy to switch back to Miles to gain the additional reroll. I wouldn't be opposed to doing it the other way either, but I think this is another, I mean, in both the examples we talked about, what we're really talking about is two good characters who don't need to have their leaderships on the board anymore, especially since Steve has been changed, but have compelling leaderships on them, right? And I think these two affiliations check that way more than anyone else does. I mean, Sinon and Red Skull are the other one, but like, I don't really like taking Red Skull as a support piece, and then they want really different rosters, right?
Yeah, and I think they don't have great synergy with each other for their leaderships because Red Skull tends to be hanging out the back, doesn't do much with Sin's leadership. Sin doesn't need the extra power generation from Red Skull. Even though her attacks are good at generating the power from his leadership, she just has like infinite power and no way to spend it. So I agree that Cabal is like, it would be okay, but I don't love it there. I think the other one that I'm interested in is Brotherhood, because Magneto's leadership is very variable depending on terrain and can expire by the mid game, right? Where you've just burned through all the terrain on the table. And it might be a nice option to switch to Mystique, who herself is a character that often sees play under Magneto, even if you're not planning to use her leadership.
That's an interesting one that I hadn't considered. Just like, I'm literally out of terrain to throw, so I would like to have an active leadership again.
Yeah.
Because generally speaking, we've talked before, I don't really enjoy Mystique's leadership. But it's better than no leadership. And right. Playing Magneto, it is not uncommon, especially Magneto Juggernaut. I'll mention this. Like, there's definitely some anti-synergy there as well. Like, yeah, I got a lot of power, but like, sometimes I just want to throw stuff in round five and there's just nothing left, right? My opponent's throwing terrain to limit me on what I can throw. Juggernaut's incidentally blowing stuff up because I'm trying to move him up the table. You know, Magneto's throwing nine pieces of terrain around and all of a sudden there's nothing left. So that's an interesting idea, swapping back over to Mystique.
Yeah. I also think it's worth mentioning that if you start with Mystique's leadership, your base versatile strategy is basically like the X-Men card First Class, right? First Class, probably the best X-Men card, the one that sees the most play. That is, your interactions on round one cost one less power, right? The first time you interact, it doesn't cost power. But, I mean, Mystique's leadership is basically that, right? The first time you interact, you get power back. So you can play, start with Mystique's leadership, play versatile strategy at the end of round one before you activate Magneto, right? Because one of the things that's happened with these rules updates is we don't have Valkyrie anymore able to start the throw chain. So maybe instead of having an unaffiliated thrower TT to start our Brotherhood throw chains that we're so fond of, maybe we have Mystique give us a power discount. We use that for all of our interactions on round one where you're doing the most interacting with objectives. And then we switch to Magneto's leadership with him activating last and giving us power from it at the end of round one. And we're basically getting two leaderships in the first round.
It's an interesting way to go about it, right? I really like Juggernaut starting the throw chain now. I'm sure you've enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, it's good.
It's definitely an interesting way to go about it. I think the... Man. Okay, so we're taking Mothership. I think we agree that we're taking Deception, right?
Yeah, probably.
Probably?
Well, okay, we'll I think... But later. You've got another reason to take Mystique here, right? So I don't think you have to take Deception, but I mean, I'd like to.
Okay. We're taking Do You Know My Name if we're playing Juggernaut.
Yeah, I don't think you have to play Juggernaut in this idea, right? You've got Magneto, Mystique, plus other characters you like in Brotherhood.
Okay, that's a fair point. Yeah, I'm not opposed to it. My issue with Brotherhood has always been they have a lot of solid tactics cards. They don't have a lot of Mothership is A tier, right? But right. They have a lot of like C plus to B level tactics cards, and picking between them can always be a challenge for me, right?
Yes, that's true. They have a lot to choose from, so adding one more is difficult. But there are times, right, on certain scenario combinations that saving yourself the power so you can interact with everything is a big deal. Like if you're on like a cube or spiders extract plus like a pay to flip secure, and you're like, oh, I wish I had all the power I needed to interact with all this stuff. Like having Mystique's leadership in round one plus Magneto's could be exactly what you want.
Yeah, I just... It feels like I'm using a tactics card to get something I could take with just a different character selection. Like, I understand it's harder to start the throw chain for a variety of reasons, right? A, they change the way the terrain interacts with each other, and B, they nerf Valkyrie. But if you have a character that can still perform a decent-sized throw, you can end up with the same effect, right? Sure. Given we're talking about activations as opposed to tactics cards. So, I like the idea of it. I just have to, in my head, I just have concerns about it, I guess, is all I'm trying
to say. I think it probably depends which characters you favor for Brotherhood, right? Because, if, like you said, if you're taking ones which are all fueling Magneto's leadership, then it kind of is unnecessary to ever use Mystique's leadership, right? But if you're not, then, and you still want to play with Magneto, then this is perhaps an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, I like the idea. I'm just working it through in my head, and I'm just not 100% sure on it. But I think we both like versatile strategy. I think it's a nice versatile card. I think we kind of highlighted the big ones where it's going to fit. I don't love it in Cabal. I don't love it in Uncanny X-Men. Sorry, Cyclops.
I think one thing that's worth mentioning with Uncanny X-Men is there's a little bit of inherent synergy with their two leaderships, right? In that Storm's leadership... Cover is better earlier in the game when characters are further apart. Yep. And the place is better earlier in the game because once you've got a bunch of extracts, those characters can't use the effect, right? Cyclops' leadership is better later in the game where you've got the power to spend to fuel it. So that's some synergy. The problem is Cyclops' leadership is just not really ever worth using. So, but if that wasn't true, if that caveat wasn't there, the inherent synergy between those two leaderships is pretty strong.
Great. Okay. Great point, Pat. So I think all in all, I think we're both pretty high on the Juggernauts box. I've really enjoyed him playing him. I think you have as well in the games you've gotten with him. I think he's going to be an impactful piece, whether you're a Brotherhood player or looking to splash a really tanky unaffiliated piece. We really like what Kane Marco brings. If you're dedicated Avengers or Web Warrior players, you might end up picking it up just for versatile strategy, which I know people don't love about the game, but I don't know, it doesn't really bother me that much. So, Juggernaut seems amazing. Seems unstoppable.
Yeah, he's so unique. He's so cool. If you like him, take this box. You won't be disappointed.
All right. In the after-the-credit scenes, we have a special throwback coming your way. If you're not familiar with the after-the-credit scenes, at this point, it's basically a bonus episode. The last one was 28 minutes long, where Pat and I can answer Patreon questions for... just some interesting discussions. You can check that out. You can become a patron at patreon.com/AcrossTheBifrost. You can find all of our work at AcrossTheBifrost.com. We do appreciate each and every one of you for listening. Until next time, everyone, cheers and happy gaming.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, way up high, there's a in a lullaby, somewhere across the Bifrost skies are blue. that you dare to dream really do come true.